Zek disappeared through the hatch into the aft cargo hold, and a few minutes later, Jaina felt him open to the battle meld that Jedi used to communicate while flying stealth X's. The Dactyl gave a little shudder as the rear cargo door slid open, altering its atmospheric flight profile. She turned back to her observation blister, and a moment later saw Zek's stealth X dropping away behind them. Jaina sent him a good hunting wish through the Force, then unbuckled her crash webbing and went aft to close the cargo door and prepare the Dactyl for landing. By the time she had finished, Jag was already flying through the hollowed-out cliff face that served as the entrance to the Academy's main hangar. A hint of danger sense tickled Jaina between the shoulder blades, and she went forward to join Jag on the flight deck. "Everything okay?" she asked.
"Of course."
Jag was sitting in the pilot's seat in the textbook posture, his back straight, both eyes forward, and both hands on the steering yoke. He slipped the ungainly Dactyl into the berthing area outlined by the green lights on the floor, and did not look over until the vessel had settled onto its landing struts.
"Why do you ask?"
Jaina peered through the forward viewport.
"Something feels wrong."
Jag frowned, driving the scar on his brow downward like a lightning bolt.
"Wrong how?"
Jaina only shrugged and continued to study the hangar floor. Like the rest of the Academy, it was strangely deserted. Finally, she said,
"Just empty. Have you ever seen a hangar this quiet?"
"Not an active one."
Jag unbuckled his crash webbing, then stood and attached his blaster holster to his belt.
"Do you think Alima could have already done something?"
Jaina's musings were interrupted by the crackle of the cockpit speaker.
"How long are you going to stay down there looking for go-cobs?"
asked a throaty female voice.
"I'd like to hear what you found on your security sweep."
Jag cocked a questioning brow in Jaina's direction.
"I guess there's only one way to find out."
She leaned down and opened a channel to reply.
"Sorry, Command. We'll be right up."
"Very well,"
answered the flight control commander, a Duros woman named Orami.
"Just watch out for the go-cobs. The smell up here is bad enough."
"Will do."
Jaina closed the channel, then frowned in confusion.
"What is it with her and go-cobs today?"
"What are go-cobs?"
Jag asked.
"I'll explain on the way."
Jaina turned to leave the flight deck. By the time they had left the Dactyl and reached the lift that would take them to the flight control bunker, Jag had heard more about go-cobs than anyone would enjoy knowing.
"So Orami is telling us to watch out for over-friendly vermin?"
Jag asked.
"Basically."
Jaina snapped the lightsaber off her belt and stepped into the lift, then motioned for Jag to follow.
"Coming?"
"Of course."
He flicked the safety off his blaster, then asked,
"Stun or kill?"
"Let's stick with stun until we know what's going on,"
Jaina replied. She placed her thumb over a pad on the control panel.
"Ready?"
Jag nodded, and a few moments later, the turbolift delivered them to the flight control level. Jaina didn't sense anyone lurking in the corridor, but if Alima was out there, she wouldn't. Jaina led the way down the corridor to the flight control bunker. She could sense the usual dozen Force presences inside, all calm and seemingly focused on the task at hand. Still, she kept her lightsaber in hand as the door hissed aside to reveal a huge holo display ringed by individual control stations. Floating above the display was an image of the planet Ossus and its moons, along with numerical designators for dozens of artificial satellites. A tall Duros woman, the flight commander named Orami, motioned to Jaina from the other side of the holo display.
"Come in! There's something I need to..."
Jaina's spine nettled with danger sense, and she sprang into a high arcing Force flip that carried her into the heart of the planetary hologram. Several of the flight controllers cried out in alarm and sprang to their feet, their hands rising from their laps, holding blaster pistols they hadn't had time to draw. Jaina ignited her lightsaber and battled half a dozen stun bolts back at the men who had fired them, then came down next to Orami.
"Jaina, no!"
Orami cried.
"You don't understand."
"I understand."
Jaina paused to return a stun bolt into the chest of a flight controller.
"That they're shooting at me."
On the opposite side of the holo display, two men fell convulsing, their tunics smoking where Jag's stun bolts had struck them from behind. Jaina force-jerked the feet from beneath one of her attackers, then pointed at another and force-hurled him across two control stations into the last man holding a weapon.
She pointed the tip of her lightsaber at this last pair of attackers, then ordered, "Don't move!" They fell motionless, as did everyone else in the chamber except Jag, who secured the door behind him and set about collecting weapons. Without looking away from the men, whoever they were, Janet tipped her head toward Arami and asked, "Go, Cobbs?"
"You might say that," she replied. "I was trying to tell you the situation stinks, but they're friendly."
"Don't seem very friendly," Jag said. "Friendlies don't fire blasters at you."
A deep voice spoke from several meters to the right, almost behind Jaina.
"They were stun bolts, and Jedi Solo did make a rather alarming entrance."
Jaina looked toward the voice and found a tall human ducking through the doorway from Arami's private office. He had a long face with sunken eyes and a blade-like nose, and he was wearing the black uniform of a GAG major. He stopped a pace outside the office and spread his hands palm out to show he was unarmed.
"Now, I would appreciate it if you would allow my men to resume their duties."
Jaina continued to hold her lightsaber at middle guard.
"I don't think so."
She cocked her head toward Arami.
"Why don't you tell me what's going on here?"
Arami waved a blue, long-fingered hand toward the Major.
"Allow me to present Major Serpa," she said. "Apparently he's here to protect us."
Serpa spread a smile that made ice seem warm.
"You never know what those terrorists might attack next."
A dark storm boiled through Jaina's veins, and she nearly didn't stop herself from force-hurling the smug Major through the nearest Durasteel wall.
"Jason is holding the Academy hostage?"
Serpa continued to smirk in her direction.
"There's no need to look at it that way."
He held his hand out toward her lightsaber.
"But it would be wise to surrender your weapons before there are any more misunderstandings."
"Not going to happen," Jaina said. "But I will give you an hour to take your men and clear out of here."
Serpa's smile vanished.
"I'm afraid that isn't going to happen either. The Colonel entrusted the safety of this facility and everyone in it to my battalion, and I won't abandon that duty, no matter who gets caught in the crossfire."
Jag's eyes narrowed, with the same outrage that Jaina found herself struggling to contain. He started towards Serpa, circling the holo display opposite Jaina so their quarry would be trapped, saying nothing. Serpa merely watched him come, his force presence betraying more excitement than fear. And Jaina suddenly realized why her brother had chosen the Major for this particular duty.
"Hold on, Jag," she said. "I don't think the Major is right in the head."
Serpa's eyes darkened, and he turned to Jaina with an air of disappointment.
"That would depend on how one defines right. But if you mean to suggest I'd enjoy destroying this facility rather than risking having it fall into, unfriendly hands."
He extended his arm toward the man Jag had been binding. A holdout blaster slid out of his sleeve into his hand, and he fired one bolt into the man's face. Arami and several GAG troopers cried out in shock. Serpa merely looked back to Jaina and smiled.
"You're absolutely right," he said. "I'm happy to kill anyone."
Jag glared at Serpa like a bug that needed crushing. But Jaina deactivated her lightsaber and motioned for Jag to lower his blaster. She could tell by the eagerness in Serpa's force aura that he was fully prepared to order the Academy's destruction, actually hoping they'd give him an excuse to do so.
"I can't believe what my brother has come to," Jaina said. "Calling on the likes of you."
"You know what they say. Desperate times and all that."
Serpa cocked his arm, and the holdout blaster vanished into his sleeve.
"Now, perhaps you'd care to surrender your weapons."
"Not really,"
Jaina said, resigning herself to working with a sociopath to capture Alima.
"And I doubt you'd want us to, if you knew why we're here."
Serpa frowned.
"I'll decide that."
"Fine," Jag said. "Do you know who Alima Rar is?"
"Of course. A Jedi Knight gone bad."
Serpa smirked again.
"Imagine that."
It happens, Jaina said, fuming. And she's here somewhere. We don't know what she's up to, but you can bet it's no good.
Serpa scowled in suspicion.
How long?
Probably since last night, Jack said. We're working off a set of vector plots that go all the way back to the Hapes Consortium, so we're fairly sure.
She came from the Consortium?
Arami interrupted.
Where in the Consortium?
On the Terrafon side, just outside the Transitory Mists, Jaina answered. A place called Roku Depot. Why?
Arami lowered the corners of her thin-lipped mouth.
I wonder if Roku Depot is between here and Cavan.
Jaina had a sinking feeling. She didn't know Hapen astronomy well enough to know the answer, but she had heard that Cavan was where Mara's body had been found.
I'd be very interested in the answer to that question, Jaina said.
Before Serpa could object, Arami tapped a string of commands into a control console. The image above the flight control holopad shifted to a map of the Hapen Consortium. Roku Depot's approximate location was noted on the fringes of the map, on the side closest to Ossus. A few dozen light years away, in the same system as Hapes, the planet Cavan sat at the far end of a hyperdrive route running straight past Roku Depot.
A straight shot, Jaina gasped.
From what the astronomy files say, yes, Arami replied. And if Ali Marar was at Roku Depot...
It's too big a coincidence, Jaina agreed. If she didn't do it, she was involved.
You can't jump to that conclusion yet, Jag warned. Remember, Alima didn't chop up that freighter crew until after Mara died. Would she really have drawn attention to herself like that so soon after the murder?
Jaina gave him a don't be stupid look and said nothing.
Okay, Jag sighed. We can assume she knows something.
At the least, Jaina said, growing more worried about the young ones by the moment. She turned to Serpa. Now do you want us to surrender our weapons?
Actually, yes, Serpa replied. Your little play was very convincing, but Ali Marar isn't on Ossus. My team has been in control of the flight room.
Would you have seen her come down in a Stealth X?
Jaina asked. She didn't bother explaining that Alima had been flying something else, a vessel they didn't quite understand, but that nevertheless seemed to be as elusive as a Stealth X. Serpa considered this a moment, then removed a comlink from his sleeve pocket and opened a channel.
Captain Tong, give me a status check on all the stations. Note anything out of the ordinary, anything at all.
As you wish, sir,
a clear female voice responded.
I'll report back in a few moments.
Instead of clicking off and waiting for a paging chirp, Serpa held out his arm and stared at the comlink, smiling and nodding to himself each time a station reported everything normal. Jaina saw that she and Jag were going to have to be very careful how they dealt with the Major, lest they prompt him to do something rash. As Serpa continued to listen to the reports, Jaina lowered her voice to a whisper and asked Arami,
What about the instructors? Why didn't they try to stop him?
Arami shook her head.
The only Jedi here are the Master Solasar and half a dozen new Jedi Knights stuck on patrol duty, she said. Everyone else went to the funeral on Coruscant.
Imagine that, Serpa said, looking up from his comlink. Stripping the Academy of its Jedi when terrorists are running rampant across the galaxy. It's fortunate we arrived when we did.
Arami's blue face darkened to purple.
The only reason your shuttle reached the ground in one piece was because you declared an emergency and requested medical assistance.
Bombardment seemed rather extreme under the circumstances, Serpa said amiably. After all, the Jedi and the Galactic Alliance Guard are on the same side.
At least we're supposed to be.
Though Jaina wasn't really surprised by the depth of Jason's treachery, she was stinging from it. He had been such a gentle spirit as a teenager, such a caring brother, that she could never have imagined what he would become as an adult, how he would wound her and the entire Jedi Order.
Frankly, I'm beginning to have my doubts.
You see? Serpa asked. That's why the Colonel sent me, to make sure we all stay friends.
I never cared for Jason's idea of friendship, Jag said. What did you find out about Alima?
You know what I found out.
Serpa flashed him a sly grin.
that wherever she is, it's not here.
You can't know that, Jaina said. Just because none of your security stations reported anything unusual...
We have a lot of security stations, Serpa interrupted. I can tell you how many Gokobs are sneaking potams from the kitchens.
Alima is no Gokob, Jaina said. She could walk right past one of your guards and he wouldn't remember seeing her.
My guards wouldn't remember seeing her.
Serpa mimicked the monotone voice often used by targets of a force suggestion, then rolled his eyes.
Please. Colonel Solo has inured us to your Jedi mind tricks.
This is no trick, Jag said. Alima Rar has the ability to wipe the memory of seeing her from even Jedi minds. It would be no challenge at all to deceive the witless Skullags in your command.
Witless Skullags?
Serpa appeared to consider the term for a moment, then nodded and extended his hand toward Jaina.
You're probably right. I'm afraid I'll have to take your weapons and comlinks now. My Skullags might mistake you for the enemy and get themselves killed.
Not going to happen, Jaina said. She nodded Jag toward the door, then started around the big holo display herself. We're going hunting for Alima Rar. Tell your people to stay out of our way.
Sorry, that won't work for me, Serpa said from behind them. As I said before, I'm not going to place this facility at risk by allowing unauthorized personnel to walk around with weapons. No matter who gets caught in the crossfire.
No prickle of danger sense ran down Jaina's spine, but there was something cold in Serpa's voice that made her stop and turn.
I hope you're not threatening the young ones.
I'm merely pointing out the danger you'll be placing them in, Serpa said evenly. The rules have been established for the safety of everyone. I really must insist on having your comlinks and weapons, if you intend to stay on Academy grounds.
Jaina frowned.
If we intend to stay, you'd let us leave?
Colonel Solo does want this operation conducted under the strictest secrecy, but...
Serpa waved a hand at the battered squad of troopers, still struggling to pick themselves up off the floor.
Does it look like I could stop you? If you want to leave Masters Tion and Solasar here with only a handful of inexperienced Jedi Knights to, coordinate between my battalion of Skullags and all those Jedi young ones, well, I'm enough of a realist to realize... The choice is entirely yours.
Jaina felt suddenly sick to her stomach. Serpa wasn't exactly threatening the young ones, but he was pointing out how much danger they would be in if the situation between Jason and the Jedi continued to deteriorate. 8 Jedi, especially when 6 of them were inexperienced, would not be enough to protect hundreds of children from an entire GAG battalion. Jag arrived at the exit and reached for the control panel to unlock the door he had secured earlier. Jaina motioned for him to stop.
Jag, hold on.
She could not believe her brother would actually order Serpa to harm the Academy students. But Jason had done many things lately that she could not believe.
I think we better turn over our weapons.
Jag scowled as though she were as unbalanced as Serpa.
Why in the 6 Novas would we do that? Same reason Masters Tion and Solasar did.
As Jaina explained, she was reaching out to Zek and the Force, opening a battle meld and urging him to forget about Alima, stay hidden, and wait until he was needed.
Because we can't destroy an entire GAG battalion without getting a lot of kids killed. And because matters aren't that desperate yet.
Serpa smiled. I thought you might see it my way.
You can be very persuasive.
Jaina opened her lightsaber and removed the focusing crystal.
I'm sure that's why my brother entrusted you with this mission.
A sudden compulsion to hide welled up inside Alima's chest. Worried that her pursuers had found her after all, she peered over the top of the study carrel where she was working. In the front lobby,
She saw only the same two GAG troopers who had been guarding the library when she arrived. They were leaning against the front desk, talking softly and gazing into each other's eyes. The compulsion to hide became an entreaty to wait, then a premonition of trouble, and Alima realized the sensations were coming from outside herself. Someone was projecting those feelings so powerfully they had overspilled a battle meld and rippled out for just anyone to sense. Probably the Academy's GAG protectors were giving Jaina and her two lust toads more trouble than they had Alima, and that was a relief. The trio had been hounding Alima's trail since Roku Depot, and she had known it would only be a matter of time before they caught up and began to snoop around the Academy. Alima stretched her force awareness out toward the female guard, then focused her attention on the drone coming from the woman's comlink.
Enter escort, searching enemy grounds.
The voice was male and assertive, no doubt that of the mission commander.
Don't interfere, but don't let them... the hostages.
Hostages? Stunned to hear the term actually being used over a comm channel, Alima dropped back into her seat. She had known all along that the GAG troops were there to prevent the Academy from being used to foment resistance to Jason's coup, but she had never suspected he would actually be foolish enough to take the young ones hostage. It was a bold move, but also a rash one, far more likely to provoke Luke than to contain him. Alima did not understand how Jason could have made such a mistake. Until now, his stratagems had been nothing short of brilliant. He had won over the population of Coruscant and much of the rest of the Alliance with his tough-on-terrorist approach, and he had used his popularity to take personal control of nearly half the galaxy. So why had he made such a terrible blunder now? Why had he suddenly grown arrogant enough to believe he could threaten the Jedi Order and succeed? The answer, of course, was Lumaya. Jason had not blundered until his mentor was killed. Then, within days of her death, he had overreached himself. Obviously, the Colonel still needed guidance, and Lumaya had clearly foreseen that he would. Why else would she have allowed Alima to follow her to her asteroid hideout? Lumaya had wanted to make sure that if she were gone, Alima would have the resources to carry on in her place. Alima linked her datapad to the archives computer she had been accessing, then downloaded the limited data she had found regarding the vessel she had inherited from Lumaya. According to Jedi histories, Ship, it refused to reveal its name, so Alima just called it Ship, was an ancient meditation sphere, a sort of thinking starship that had at one time been used by Jedi and Sith alike. From what little the records had revealed, the meditation sphere was a sort of force-augmented control vessel designed to amplify a commander's battle meditation abilities while also concealing his or her location from the enemy. The datapad displayed a message announcing that it had completed the download. Alima deactivated the data link and erased her access trail on the main computer, then tucked the datapad into its pouch on her utility belt and started toward the exit. The hike up to Ship's hiding place wasn't particularly difficult, even with Alima's damaged foot and useless arm. As Alima approached the ravine where Ship had concealed itself, the strong-willed vessel rose into view without waiting for a summons. It was fantastically hideous. A bloated orb with a web of raised veins pulsing over an amber-colored hull that could be opaque or transparent depending on its mood. It held its four wings folded flat against the sides of its round belly, and as it spun to face her, it looked to Alima like a giant disembodied brain. A very old giant disembodied brain.
Ancient,
Ship corrected. A 2-meter section of hull melted into a ramp and extruded itself toward the bank where Alima was standing. The reproach in Ship's thoughts was unmistakable, but Alima merely smirked and strolled up the ramp at her own relaxed pace. They had nothing to fear from these enemies, at least not at the moment. Wisely or unwisely, Jason had given them something more important to worry about than Alima Rar. Ship was doubtful, but it waited until Alima was kneeling inside, then sealed itself up and awaited a destination.
Can Sector, Alima said aloud. We assume you remember the coordinates of Lumaya's asteroid.
In the next instant, Alima found herself pressed against the rear bulkheads as ship accelerated skyward.
A sense of frustration flooded the force as one of her pursuers, Zek, judging by the labored purity of his presence, alerted his fellows to her escape. Jaina's reaction was not discernible, but the fact that no one launched a shadow bomb or a proton torpedo at ship told Alima all she needed to know. For now, her hunters had more pressing matters on their minds. The journey to the Kant sector was uneventful as it was unnerving. When the asteroid had grown so large that nothing else could be seen ahead, ship swung around to its dark side and made a breakneck hangar approach. At the last possible moment, a camouflage blast door slid open and ship shot into the hideaway's cramped hangar, decelerating so hard that Alima had to force anchor herself in place to keep from being hurled into the forward bulkhead. Ship stopped almost a meter from the far wall and extruded three landing struts, then settled onto the hangar floor, hissing, creaking, and groaning as though it were the Millennium Falcon. Ship repressurized, then shaped a door and ramp for her.
"Wait for us here," Alima said, rising. "You may as well top off your fuel and tend to your maintenance needs. This may take a few hours."
Ship seemed amused by that, and Alima had the distinct impression that it expected her to be here much longer than a few hours. Forever, probably.
"In that case,"
Alima said, descending the ramp,
"if we fail to return within 100 years, consider yourself released."
Alima crossed the hangar to the hatch that led into Lumaya's chambers, then began to work her way past the gauntlet of traps that had once protected the privacy of the Dark Lady of the Sith. First, there was the flechette spray behind the false control pad at the entrance. Then came the airlock with the reverse controls and the poison decontamination shower, followed by a clever force illusion of Lumaya herself that somehow transferred the damage of any attack directed at it back to the assailant. Alima really wanted to learn how that was done, once the throbbing inside her skull subsided enough for her to concentrate. Finally, Alima found herself standing inside the foyer of Lumaya's suite of chambers, her leku prickling in anticipation of the wonders she would soon discover. Each of Lumaya's traps had whetted her appetite for Sith technology, and each time she had defeated one, her expectations had risen. Whatever Lumaya had been trying to guard, it was obviously very important and valuable. Alima began to have visions of a Sith megaweapon, something that might be able to bring the Galactic Alliance to heel with a single demonstration. Or maybe it was something more subtle, such as an artifact that allowed one to read an enemy's thoughts from afar. Maybe she would find both, or a whole cache of strange new Sith technology. All those traps had been designed to protect something. Alima advanced to a careful reconnaissance of the quarters. With a handful of beige sleeping chambers, a keyed-paneled study, a vaulted dining room, and a sunken conversation parlor, the suite was comfortable enough. But it was hardly grand or opulent, far from the kind of place that one would expect someone of Lumaya's power and resources to call home. There was no artwork or memorabilia to make it feel inhabited, though the full-length mirrors on every wall did hint at Lumaya's vanity. Unfortunately, she discovered no secret chambers behind the mirrors, or anywhere else in the suite. The only hint of a secure room was an ancient synthwood door tucked in back of an old-fashioned kitchen. Alima checked for each kind of trap she had encountered so far, then for all the others she had been trained to identify. Finding none, she opened herself to the Force and ran her hand over the door's surface, alert for the faintest prickle of danger sense. She felt nothing. Whatever trap Lumaya had placed on this door, Alima could not find it. And that could only mean one thing. This was where the Sith treasures were hidden. Alima stepped back, taking a moment to calm her pounding heart and consider how to attack the problem. There was no question of leaving the door unopened. To restore the balance between her and Leia, she had to turn Jason into what Leia hated most, another Emperor. To turn Jason into another Emperor, she had to be able to control him, to stop him from doing foolish things like taking the Jedi Academy hostage. And to control Jason, she needed leverage. Leverage such as the Sith artifacts hidden behind that door.
Alima took a small concussion grenade off her utility belt, then used a dab of synth glue to affix it to the door over the lock. She retreated into the adjacent room and used the force to activate the trigger. There came a silver flash and an ear-splitting bang, and a cloud of black smoke rolled into the dining room. Once the smoke had cleared, Alima braved a shower of fire suppression foam to return to the kitchen. The door in back was hanging twisted and half open. Alima activated a glow rod and peered through the charred doorway into an old food storage closet. The shelves were lined with cybernetic supplies, tools, fluids, replacement parts, all the equipment Lumaya might need to maintain her mechanical half. As far as Alima could tell, the little room did not contain a single Sith artifact. Completely forgetting her own safety now, she slipped past the door. An overhead glow panel activated automatically, filling the chamber with soft white light. Along one wall, she found a huge stockpile of powdered mixes for the protein and vitamin drinks that had served Lumaya's half-cyborg body as food. On a low shelf on the opposite wall, she found a few power cells and extra strands for the Dark Lady's light whip.
Spare parts?
Alima felt herself swelling up with anger, the frustration and fear of the search stoking the fire inside.
Protein drink?
She swept half a dozen powdered protein canisters off a shelf, then kicked out in the opposite direction and sent flying a carton of sharpened kyber crystals. That felt so good that she ignited her lightsaber, then caused a sour-smelling cascade of hydraulic fluid by slashing open an entire row of plastoid jars.
We want artifacts!
Alima swung again, cutting the supports from beneath a high shelf.
We want Sith treasure!
A cybernetic arm came crashing down on her, battering her about the head and shoulders. She shrugged it off and started to bring her lightsaber around to hack the offending part into so much chaff, then noticed a finger-length data chip holder lying in the hydraulic fluid near the open end of the arm's helenium casing.
Well, what have we here?
Alima deactivated her lightsaber and retrieved the data chip holder.
Could you be the reason Lumaya kept this door locked?
She stared at the fibroplast case as though waiting for an answer, which in a sense she was. After a moment, she began to perceive a faint ripple in the Force, the barest hint of the last emotion she had expected to encounter. Hope, perhaps even comfort.
Interesting,
Alima said.
What are you?
This time she did not wait for an answer. Despite what Ship believed, she was not that broken. Instead, she looked for more data chips, first searching through the other cybernetic supplies, then the kyber crystals she had scattered across the floor and the other cartons of light whip parts. She ended by emptying every canister of vitamin drink and powdered protein into the growing mess on the floor. There were no more data chips to be found, though Alima did discover over 1 million credits in generic chits hidden inside some of the protein canisters. She left the currency on the floor with everything else she did not want. Credits she could get any time, and stealing them was always so much more fun. Convinced there was nothing else to discover in the food closet, Alima returned to Lumaya's study and inserted the chip into a data pad. She expected to encounter a request for a password or some other form of security. Instead, a hooded head appeared on the display and instantly began to speak.
Our apologies for the brevity of your journey.
The speaker's face remained hidden in the shadows beneath his hood, but the voice was male and full of dark power.
Had we foreseen the speed of the invaders' advance, we would have sent a more sizable escort. Should you survive and care to reach us on your own, the navigation string attached to this message will guide you. Once.
The figure appeared to lean away from the light, and the display went dark. Alima extracted the data chip, then sat back to consider. She had been taught as a young Jedi that only two Sith existed at any one time. The dark side drive for personal power always prevented them from establishing a larger order. But Lumaya had once hinted in the missile hold of the Anakin Solo, as she made preparations that might involve sacrificing herself to kill Luke Skywalker, that there were more than two Sith, and that their plan for the galaxy did not necessarily involve Lumaya's survival. The figure in the message certainly supported this idea. At the least, he seemed to be a part of a larger group. Alima returned the data chip to its holder and started for the hangar. Clearly, she had set her sights too low. She did not need Sith artifacts to guide Jason to success. What she needed were the Sith themselves.
Near Balmora, aboard the Anakin Solo.
To the starboard side of the observation bubble hung a crescent of smog-shrouded world, its planetary defense shields dappled with gold overload circles, its legendary defense platforms reduced to flickering twinkles of flame. Balmora was lost. Jason was certain of that. But the Confederation would pay dearly for victory here, provided the pilots of the Fourth Fleet lived up to their fearless reputation, and provided that he could finally bring his battle meditation into play. When Jason closed his eyes, he could see the Hutt Armada, a motley swarm of vessels ranging from heavy marauders to fast corvettes, attacking Balmora. He could see a flotilla of Kaminoian Star Destroyers performing a screening action to keep the Alliance at bay. What Jason could not see was the readiness of his crews, whether they were eager for a fight, whether their commanders were alert or distracted, whether they were loyal to the new government or considered it an illegal regime. Jason turned his attention to the Fourth's new flagship, Peacebringer, then pictured Admiral Rotobo's noseless face, the big eyes and huge bald head. The image darkened to a gray-blue, and a pair of pensive creases climbed the Bith's high brow. For a moment, Jason sensed Rotobo's distaste for the battle they would soon be fighting, and his anger at the politicians for allowing it to become necessary. The voice of a female comm officer came over the intercom.
Colonel Solo, hollow for you on GAG channel back to 2.
Kaidus scowled. Not now, Ensign.
I'm sorry, sir, but it's top urgent priority, and it's Lieutenant Krova, sir.
Not anymore, Kaidus retorted, deliberately allowing his frustration over the failed battle meditation to creep into his voice. What part of Never Disturb?
It's Ben Skywalker, sir.
Krova's voice was cracking with anxiety, but she pressed on.
He said to tell you he knows who killed his mother.
Kaidus' heart suddenly felt like a cold, still stone. He does. That's wonderful news. He touched a pad on his armrest, and his heavy meditation chair slowly spun toward the tiny holonet transceiver tucked next to the bubble entrance. Very well, Lieutenant. Transfer the signal. Kaidus tapped the control pad on his armrest, and a moment later Ben's shoulders and head appeared over the projector pad. It was the first Kaidus had seen of his younger cousin since Mara's funeral, and the boy was holding up better than expected. Deciding to forgo the sympathetic act he had planned, Kaidus put on a slightly distracted expression, then said, "This'll have to be quick, Ben. We're about to counterattack."
"It will be."
There was a sharpness in Ben's voice, and his brow was knitted in anger.
"I only have one question."
"Very well." Kaidus changed to a slightly bewildered tone. He knew what was coming, and he had a plan to handle it. "Go ahead." Ben narrowed his eyes.
"Did you kill Mom?"
Kaidus shot his brow up, as though shocked, and it was not entirely an act. He was surprised at how directly Ben had put the question. "Did I what?" Kaidus sank back in his chair and shook his head in feigned bewilderment. "You think I killed Mara? Why?"
"You were there, in the consortium."
"A lot of people were there. Are you going to accuse us all in the hope that someone confesses?"
"I don't have to. You're already confessing."
Kaidus frowned. "Okay, Ben. How am I acting like I did it?"
"By trying to keep Dad and the Masters off balance. You don't want them to find out it was you."
"If you're talking about trying to arrest my parents at the Jedi Temple, that was strictly a protective measure. Captain Shivu had reports of Bothan smuggling a proton bomb onto the planet, and my mother and father are known terrorists. With most of our Jedi Masters at the funeral..."
"I suppose there's another bomb on Ossus?"
"Not that I know of, and I intend to keep it that way. The GAG battalion I placed on Ossus is strictly a security measure."
"Come on, Jason. You took the Academy hostage. You're just trying to keep the Order from coming after you."
"I'm trying to protect the students." Your father isn't himself right now, and the Council has been handling your mother's death very foolishly. If I can land an entire battalion on Ossus, what do you think the Bothans could do?
Bothans wouldn't have our clearance codes, and nobody would make the mistake of thinking they're on our side.
Seeing that Ben was not being persuaded, Kytus decided to change tactics. He sighed wearily, then said, I should have known better than to try fooling you, Ben. The truth is that our office, and by that I mean the Joint Chiefs of State, has been hurt badly by the lack of support from the Jedi Council. Ben wrinkled his brow.
So you killed Mom?
No, Ben. That was someone else. But I've been trying to take advantage of the situation. The Alliance needs a united front right now, and with your father so consumed by his grief, well, I've been trying to consolidate power in the Chief's office. Ben looked more bewildered than ever.
You're trying to take over the Jedi Order?
Kytus shook his head. Neutralize it. Perhaps Saba and the other Masters will think twice about what they say in public if they remember that the safety of the Order's younglings is in my hands. To his credit, Ben wasn't foolish enough to say that Jason would never harm the Academy students.
What about all that stuff you said at the funeral about trying to get along better with the Jedi?
That would be nice, but I haven't been able to talk with your father since the funeral, Kytus said. Frankly, I think he's been avoiding me. What else am I to do?
Well, taking over the Academy doesn't seem like a very good idea. You're just going to make people mad.
I'm sorry about that, Kytus said. But it's for the good of the Alliance.
The good of the Alliance?
The disbelief in Ben's voice was reflected in his eyes.
Right, just like killing Mom.
Kytus exhaled in frustration. Your interrogation technique is excellent, Ben. The conversation was hardly going as he had planned, and perhaps it was time to change that. But no matter how long you continue to assert the suspicion, I won't confess to what Cal... He stopped abruptly. To what someone else did. The slip worked exactly as planned. Ben's eyes widened in excitement, then quickly narrowed.
To what who did?
Kytus looked Ben straight in the eye, holding the gaze just long enough to make sure it looked like an act. Ben, if I knew who killed Mara, don't you think they'd be dead by now?
That depends on how useful they were.
Kytus winced, but only on the outside. Inside, he was smiling. Ben had gone from accusing him of Mara's murder to demanding that he reveal the name of the guilty party. As he had foreseen, Ben was more interested in vengeance than justice. All Kytus need do was point him toward a plausible target. Ben, I don't know anything.
But you have your suspicions.
Kytus let a moment of silence hang between their images, then finally nodded. He poised a finger over the transfer pad, then dropped his finger. The familiar voice of Cal Omos began to crackle from his transceiver speakers, and he assumed by Ben's shocked expression from those at the other end of the channel.
I do have allies on the Jedi Council, and Luke is one of them. But he's not going to intervene. He doesn't believe it's proper for the Jedi to insert themselves into domestic politics.
There was just enough static to make it sound like the statement had been captured during an eavesdropping operation, and to hide the electronic glitches that invariably arose when someone's words were digitally rearranged.
No, I'm saying we need Skywalker out of the way. Then my friends will be free to act on their own authority and reinstate me.
Omos's voice paused again. This was captured via parabolic dish, Kytus said, explaining the reason they only had one side of the conversation. The comlink he was using belonged to the lieutenant in charge of guarding him. We didn't have it tapped at the time. Ben nodded his understanding, and Omos's voice continued.
Are you crazy? We can't do that to Luke Skywalker, even if we knew someone who could. Just redirect his attention.
Omos paused again, and Kytus could see that the anger and hatred Ben had been holding barely under control was quickly rising to the surface.
Look, I really don't want to know how you plan to do it. Just make it happen.
The recording had barely clicked to an end before Ben's voice was blaring from the transceiver.
Who is he talking to? Fett?
We don't know yet. Kydus had to bite back a smile at the idea of sicking Ben on Fett, except that he still hoped to make an apprentice of Ben, and he was fairly certain Fett would not come out at the worse end of that fight. It's one more reason to be patient. Sooner or later, Omos is going to have to pay up, and when he does, the credits will lead us straight to your mother's murderer.
I know who my mother's murderer is, and before he dies, he's going to tell me who his weapon was.
Near Kominor, aboard the Anakin Solo.
A turbolaser strike blossomed against the Anakin Solo's shields, and space beyond the observation bubble flared into sapphire brilliance. The blast tinting darkened against the glare, leaving Kydus momentarily blind. Though hardly unaware, he could still sense the doubt threatening to engulf the entire Fourth Fleet, and he could feel the Force shuddering at the sudden detonation of the frigate Zoli. He could even perceive the fury of Admiral Rotobo, who had twice interrupted his meditations to demand authorization to break off. By any sensible military standard, Kydus should have granted the authorization as soon as the Kominorians opened fire with long-range turbolasers. The tactical planners had not expected the new technology when they proposed a frontal assault, and now the Fourth would be exposed to a barrage during its entire approach. At the same time, the fleet would be unable to return fire until it reached standard range, since even the largest Star Destroyers could not energize long-range batteries and still have enough power to maneuver and maintain shields. But Kydus could not break off now. The future was such a tangle of possibility that he could flow walk only a short time forward to the next battle, the one at Kuat that he had foreseen, before the path vanished into a miasma of uncertainty. Even with Tenel Ka's home fleet underway to join them at Kuat, the Alliance simply was not strong enough to guarantee victory. To triumph there, Kydus needed to extract a heavy price here. He had to make the attackers pay so dearly for Balmora that the Hutt and Kominorian fleets would be reduced to mere skeletons. And the Force seemed to be suggesting that Kydus had made the right decision. The blast tinting finally faded and restored Kydus's view. The battle ahead was a vast web of light and energy flashing against the pearly disk of a smog-cloaked Balmora, with clusters of blue dots, the efflux nozzles of the Fourth Fleet, accelerating through a storm of blossoming color toward the dark specks of Kominorian capital ships. Save for damaged vessels trailing smoke plumes as they plunged down Balmora's gravity well, the Hutt fleet was too distant to be seen by the naked eye. But Kydus could tell by the smug satisfaction he sensed in the Hutt commanders, and by the utter desperation of the defenders, that the landing had already begun. This much he had foreseen. There had never been any question of saving Balmora, only of how much he could make the rebels pay for taking it. The blue dots ahead narrowed to ovals as the Fourth Fleet began to turn. For a moment, Kydus thought the fleet was simply maneuvering, approaching on the oblique in order to present their flanks to the enemy and relieve their forward shields. But when the ovals continued to narrow and began to sprout blunt blue tails, he knew that he was wrong, that the fearless Fourth was breaking off. Kydus had Lieutenant Krova open an audio channel to the Peacebringer and was quickly put through to Admiral Rotobo. You appear to have decided I'm an idiot.
That's not a mistake I would make, Colonel.
Beneath the resolve in Rotobo's voice, there was a note of resignation. Clearly, he realized that by disobeying Kydus' orders, he was sacrificing not only his career, but possibly his life as well.
However, your lack of tactical training is telling. There's no question of winning the battle now.
Winning battles is your concern, Admiral, Kydus said. Winning the war is mine. Rotobo fell silent for a moment, then said,
Very well. I'll resume our attack immediately.
Thank you, Admiral. As Kydus replied, he suddenly grew aware of something else in the Peacebringer's future, something it would not avoid. I'm glad you trust me.
I wouldn't say that, Colonel, but I find I no longer have a legitimate basis for challenging your orders. If you don't choose to court-martial me after the battle, I'll be submitting my...
A resignation really won't be necessary, Admiral, Kydus said. Just carry on. And quickly. Kydus closed the channel and watched impatiently as the Fourth's ion tails slowly changed back to ovals. Kydus strengthened his battle meditation until he started to touch individual beings, then tried to imbue his Force presence with confidence and calm. The fleet reflected back only confusion and fear. perhaps because Kaidus himself did not understand exactly what he expected to happen. An aura of cold loss drew the focus of Kaidus' battle meditation back to the Peacebringer. Giving up on his attempt to improve morale, he touched a pad on the armrest of his chair. "Transfer fleet flag to the Trucemaker," he said. "Inform Admiral Darklighter he's now in command."
"You're relieving Admiral Rotobo?"
Krova asked, clearly astonished. "Not exactly." As Kaidus spoke, a dozen crimson bolts converged in the distance outside his observation bubble, and he felt the familiar force shudder of thousands of lives ending in a millisecond.
"Oh,"
Krova gasped.
"Transferring flag now."
It was hardly the smooth transition Kaidus had hoped for, and he had to endure several seconds of shock and despair as the Fourth reacted to the loss of its beloved commander. He monitored the comm channels until Gavin Darklighter, newly transferred from the Fifth after his promotion to Rear Admiral, issued a string of orders and immediately refocused the fleet on the job of destroying the Kaminoian defenders. Within seconds, the Fourth's entire starfighter screen began to stream away from the fleet, rushing to swarm the Kaminoian capital ships. The maneuver was as bold as it was unconventional, designed to force the enemy Star Destroyers to divert power from their long-range turbolasers to their shields. Kaidus touched a control panel on his armrest. "Open a channel to Admiral Darklighter. Urgent priority." Krova acknowledged the order, then reported.
"Admiral Darklighter will be available in a moment, Colonel."
"A moment?" Kaidus fumed. "Did you tell his aide?"
"Of course. She said he was aware of the priority."
Kaidus scowled. "Did she?" He focused his attention on the Trucemaker. "Very well. Thank you, Lieutenant." It took only a few moments to pick out Gavin Darklighter, a still confident presence amid a swirling mass of worried subordinates. Kaidus charged his own presence with the irritation he felt at being put off, and then began to press down on the Admiral through the Force. Darklighter seemed more irritated than intimidated, and the comm speaker remained silent. Kaidus was about to press harder when the Kaminoian turbolaser suddenly fell dark. The tiny specks of their capital ships began to drift across Balmora's pearly face, tails of blue efflux flickering at their sterns. Rather than gamble with Darklighter and hope their starfighter complement would be as efficient as the well-trained wings of the Alliance, the Kaminoians were retreating. Kaidus found the retreat doubly surprising. First, it would allow the Fourth Fleet within turbolaser range of the Hutt landing force. Second, he had not sensed it coming. The maneuver had been one of those rare, pivotal moves that even the Force could not anticipate. The kind that made fools of tactical planners and Force diviners alike. Darklighter's presence became tinged with smugness. Then his voice came over the comm speaker.
"Yes, Colonel."
Kaidus released the pressure he had been applying and swallowed the irritation he still felt at being put off. "I just wanted to congratulate you on a brilliant tactic. It took even me by surprise."
"Thank you, sir."
Darklighter paused, then asked,
"Are you telling me you sent an urgent priority summons to congratulate me?"
"Let's just say I'm happy with your performance." Kaidus kept his tone light. "How did you know the Kaminoians would retreat?"
"Let's just say I'm happy with their choice."
Darklighter's tone was not quite as light as Kaidus's had been.
"Will that be all, Colonel? I need to keep an eye on those hotshot squadron leaders."
"Yes, thank you." Kaidus started to close the channel, then decided he couldn't afford to alienate Darklighter. "And Gavin?"
"Yes, Colonel."
"I apologize for any pressure you may have felt regarding your decision."
"Don't worry about it, Colonel,"
Darklighter said.
"You're still young. You'll learn."
He closed the channel and was gone before Kaidus could react to the condescension. Kaidus was surprised when an instant later, the Force blossomed with Jedi presences. He felt dozens of them, perhaps as many as 100, all somewhere nearby, all strong and clear and resolute. His battle meditation vanished in an eruption of fear and anger, and he force leapt from his chair, doing a reverse flip over the seat back, his head passing so close beneath the upper bulkhead that his hair brushed the durasteel. Kaidus came down 3 meters inside his day cabin, his lightsaber in hand, and ignited, his gaze fixed on the still secure hatch on the wall opposite. There were no Jedi inside the day cabin with him, nor could he sense any coming through the corridor. creeping through the ventilation ducts overhead or crawling through the mechanical tunnels beneath the deck. But that didn't mean they weren't coming for him. If Kaidus could hide his presence in the Force, so could the Masters, as Mara had demonstrated when she nearly killed him on Cavan. A raspy voice sounded from Kaidus' left.
Has some furniture offended you?
Quiet! Kaidus glanced toward the voice and saw SDXX, his Tondrando Arms security droid, stepping out of the hidden security station where he kept himself stowed. They're here.
Who?
The droid's photoreceptors darkened as he switched scanning protocols.
I detect no living beings within 30 meters.
No? Kaidus frowned. The presences of the Jedi were stronger than ever, distinct enough now that he could recognize many of them. Saba Sebatin, Kip Durin, Corran Horn, most of the Masters along with Tesser, Lubaka, and more Jedi Knights than he could name. Yet when he tried to get a sense of their location, they seemed to be everywhere and nowhere, as if they were inside his head, just as they might feel during a Jedi battle meld. The Jedi weren't hunting him, he realized. They were reaching out to the Anakin Solo, inviting him to join their meld. As confused as he was relieved, Kaidus deactivated his lightsaber. The droid stalked to his compartment in utter silence and vanished back into the wall. Kaidus returned to his bubble, but made no attempt to resume his battle meditation. Instead, Kaidus unmasked his presence and opened himself to their meld. It was full of half-familiar feelings, of purpose and commitment and hope, of inclusion and fellowship and warmth. None of it directed at him, of course. Once the meld had adjusted to his arrival, Kaidus began to get a clearer picture of the Jedi purpose. They were here with what seemed to be a whole wing of stealth X's, over 70 craft if the Techs had managed to put all of them into action, and they seemed ready to fight. To his relief, the mental images he kept glimpsing were the sterns of the Imperial-class destroyers and Empire-era cruisers. The Jedi were targeting Kaminoian capital ships. Kaidus could not quite keep a smug feeling of triumph from seeping into the meld. The occupation of the Academy was working even better than expected. He projected his pleasure into the meld, simultaneously welcoming the Jedi to the battle and inviting them to open fire. The only response was stony displeasure, and no shadow bombs erupted in the sterns of the Kaminoian capital ships. A sense of expectation filled the meld, the same sense of expectation he had been experiencing since the battle opened, and he had the sinking feeling that he finally understood its meaning. Kaidus punched a control pad on his armrest. Open a channel to Admiral Darklighter, urgent priority, and don't let his aide put you off this time, it's important. Krova acknowledged the order, leaving Kaidus to pound his armrest in frustration. Anyone could be surprised. He had learned that from Darklighter, and still he had advanced straight into a trap. Now the Fourth Fleet was committed to a costly attack that only the Jedi could turn into success, and Kaidus had no doubt they would demand a very steep price indeed for their cooperation. Darklighter's voice came over the speaker a moment later.
Yes, Colonel.
In the background, Kaidus could hear the rumble of discharging turbo laser batteries and the crackle of shields dissipating excess energy.
We're pretty busy right now, so I hope this isn't another message of congratulations.
It isn't, Kaidus replied. I needed to advise you that...
That help is on the way, interrupted a familiar voice behind Kaidus. Be ready to exploit.
Is that who I think it is?
Darklighter gasped.
Yes, Luke's voice replied. Carry on, Gavin.
Kaidus was already spinning his meditation chair around, but the motor was far too slow for his comfort. As soon as he had a clear path into his day cabin, he dived over the armrest and rolled to his feet, lightsaber in hand. Luke stood about a meter away, dressed in a Stealth X flight suit and staring at the weapon in Kaidus' grasp with a bemused, slightly sad scowl.
Is it still that bad between us? He asked.
You tell me. Kaidus continued to hold the lightsaber. It wasn't the Force urging me to press the attack. It was you.
And you think that was a setup? Luke asked.
I know it was. Kaidus allowed a bit of animosity to creep into his voice. You tricked me into committing the Fourth Fleet to a dangerous attack, and only you can keep it from turning into a disaster. What is it you want in return? Instead of looking smug, Luke's face fell. Nothing, Jason. We didn't set you up.
He reached into the battle meld and urged the Jedi to attack. I just wanted you to know we could have. Kytus didn't know whether Luke was ordering the Jedi to attack the Kaminoans or him. Then the Force shuddered with the stunned anguish of thousands of beings perishing in a surprise attack, and Kytus half expected to feel the Anakin Solo bucking and twisting beneath his feet. But the deck remained reassuringly steady, and no damage sirens sounded. And Kytus finally began to understand that the Jedi threat had been an empty one. Their trick had been little more than a half-hearted attempt to intimidate him, to remind him they possessed both the courage and the means to destroy him, and the Alliance. But the very fact that they had warned instead of acting betrayed their bluff. As long as GAG controlled the Academy grounds, they would never risk an assassination or treason. They were too frightened of his ruthlessness, of his brutality, for they knew that he did not lack the will. Kytus returned his lightsaber to his belt, then gestured to the small tactical holo display in the corner of his day cabin. Shall we see how the battle is progressing? Be my guest, Luke responded. As Kytus crossed the cabin, Luke turned to watch but did not follow. I think you'll be impressed, Jason. When Kytus activated the holo display, he was impressed. Most of the identifier codes for the Kaminoan capital ships were blinking in distress, their colors ranging from amber for battle impaired to deep red for totally crippled. And Gavin Darklighter was taking full advantage. The forward elements of the 4th Fleet were already moving through the enemy lines. Knowing that they stood no chance against Alliance Star Destroyers, the Hutt Marauders and Corvettes abandoned their landing force and started to withdraw. After a minute, the 4th reached turbolaser range and opened fire, targeting not the Hutt's fleeing capital ships, but the assault shuttle still dropping toward Balmora's surface. Kytus punched a comm pad on the holo display's console. Open a channel to Admiral Darklighter.
Urgent priority,
Krova finished.
Right away, Colonel.
A moment later, Darklighter asked,
What is it, Colonel?
Redirect your fire and pursue, Kytus ordered. Our first priority is the destruction of the Hutt fleet, not the landing force.
With all due respect, Colonel,
Darklighter said in a tone completely devoid of it,
we can't abandon the Balmorans to a Hutt occupation, and it's a lot easier to destroy those shuttles now than to fight their passengers dirtside.
The Balmorans will have to handle the occupation themselves, Kytus said. I want those capital ships destroyed. Better to trap the Hutts on one world than let them occupy a dozen.
Darklighter remained silent, and over the comm channel, Kytus could almost feel him struggling with his decision.
That's an order, Admiral, Kytus said. I know it seems wrong, but we're not going to defeat the Confederation by blowing up shuttles. We need to kill the big ships.
Darklighter remained silent a moment longer, then sighed.
Very well, Colonel. Redirecting fire and pursuing.
Kytus watched as the 4th Fleet accelerated after the Hutt capital ships and began to hammer their sterns. When the first Marauder designator turned red and faded into destruction, Luke's voice sounded from where he had remained standing.
You planned this. You sacrificed a whole planet.
I foresaw it,
Kytus interrupted, turning back to his uncle.
All I did was take advantage of...
He let the sentence trail off as he realized Luke was no longer standing there. Kytus frowned and extended his Force awareness, first to his entire day cabin, then to the entire Anakin Solo. He felt no sign of his uncle's presence anywhere.
Luke?
SDXX emerged from his security station and ran his electronic gaze around the perimeter of the cabin, then reported,
There's no one here, Colonel.
What about Luke Skywalker? Kytus asked. I was just talking to him.
SDXX fixed his blue photoreceptors on Kytus' face.
You were talking,
he said.
But there was no one here. I assumed your circuits were misfiring again.
No. He was here.
Kytus opened himself to the battle meld again and felt his uncle among the other Jedi, his presence filled with sadness and disapproval and admonition.
I don't know how, but he was here.
Coruscant. Coruscant Security Detention Unit.
The target sat alone in his study, turned toward a transparisteel wall where the twinkling spires of the Senate District sky towers poked through a blanket of night clouds. An aura of bitterness and regret made the room feel chill and heavy in the Force. But Ben could not be sure whether the feelings were his own or Omas's. Sitting slumped in his big chair, with disheveled hair and purple bags hanging low beneath his eyes, the disgraced chief certainly did not look like a man who was plotting a return to power. Ben turned his attention to the big Tendrando Arms guardian standing next to the chief's desk. With gray laminamium armor, thick weapons-packed arms, and a stern, downturned vocabulator opening, it was basically a VIP version of the same defender droid that had served as Ben's companion and protector during his childhood. Assuming this droid had the same internal design as his Nana, he visualized the circuit breaker hidden beneath the neck armor and used the Force to trip it. The Guardian's photoreceptors dimmed for an instant. Then there was a click as the breaker reset itself. The droid's blocky head swiveled toward the entrance alcove where Ben stood watching. Blast! Ben flipped the circuit breaker again, then heard another click. Clearly that particular design flaw had been corrected. Double blast! The Guardian raised an arm and swung it toward the entry alcove where Ben was lurking.
Do not be alarmed, the droid said.
A stream of tiny flechettes began to fly from its fingertips.
Armed intruder, take evasive action.
It was speaking to Omas, but Ben was already diving. He landed in a forward roll and pulled a gauss ball, the equivalent of a stun grenade for droids, off his equipment harness and came up flinging. The ball splatted into the Guardian's chest plate and flattened into a crackling mass of energy. Instead of turning into the buzz zombie Ben expected, the droid began to stagger about blindly, flailing its arms and spraying a line of energy bolts through the ceiling. Clearly its mag shielding had been upgraded beyond even military standards. Blast and double blast! So far, everything was going wrong on this operation. Ben somersaulted toward the droid. It changed directions and crashed into a credenza along the adjacent wall, opposite Omas's fancy desk. Ben ignited his lightsaber, then rolled to his feet. Force sprang to the droid's side and swung at its cannon arm. The laminamium was so strong that his first strike cut only halfway through. The Guardian spun toward him, its other arm coming around like a club. Its fingers spraying flechettes in random directions. Ben stepped after the cannon arm and swung again, using the Force to guide his blow. He felt his lightsaber sink into the same cut as before and slice through, then turned toward the other arm and attacked the flechette-spraying hand at the wrist. The hand clunked to the floor, but the forearm caught him in the head and knocked him into the wall. Ben slid to the floor with his skull ringing and ears spinning, but still conscious and alert, more or less. He deactivated the blade and grabbed the bottom edge of the droid's chest plate, then pulled himself up and jammed the hilt of his weapon against its armpit. Confused though it was by the gauss ball, the droid recognized its vulnerability and tried to pivot away, then held tight and reignited his lightsaber. The blade shot through the thick torso like a gamma ray, scrambling the processing core and burying Ben beneath an avalanche of armor as the ruined Guardian slumped down on top of him. Was anything going to go right? Ben used the Force to throw the Guardian off, then came up staring straight down the emitter nozzle of a Mirsan Power 5 blaster pistol. To his great relief, the next thing he saw was not a flash of death-dealing energy, but Chief Omas's puzzled face, frowning over the barrel of the weapon.
Ben?
Ben flicked his hand and sent the blaster flying. The chief watched it clatter into the wall, the confusion in his face changing to sorrow. Ben sensed no hint of comprehension or remorse in the Force to suggest that Omas felt any guilt over the death of his mother.
Ah, Ben.
Omas stepped slowly back, holding his hands in plain view and sadly shaking his head.
I'm sorry it has to be you. This is a nasty business for someone so young.
Taking care to keep his lightsaber between himself and Omas, Ben rose to his feet.
You know I'm here?
Omas dropped his head in acknowledgement.
I'm only surprised Jason has taken this long.
Jason didn't send me,
Ben said. He was fairly certain that Omas didn't understand why he was there. Not really.
I came on my own.
Omas looked doubtful.
What point is there in lying, Ben? I'm going to be dead in a few minutes.
Ben didn't deny it. Couldn't bring himself to give the man false hope.
Probably. He pointed across Omos's Rocher Wood desk to a bank of control buttons near the far edge.
Which one of those lowers the interior blast doors?
Omos cocked a graying brow, now growing curious.
So I have a few minutes longer?
Without awaiting permission, he leaned across the desk toward the buttons.
You still have to be fast, Ben. For a Jedi, you haven't been very stealthy.
Tell me about it.
Sensing no hint of deception in Omos's force aura, Ben didn't stop the chief from pressing the buttons.
But only the interior doors. Leave the viewing wall open.
Omos cast a knowing glance at his viewing wall, Ben's best escape route now that he had caused such a tumult, then touched the button. A pair of blast doors slid down to seal the study exits. He turned back toward Ben.
Now, what can I do to make this easier?
Omos gestured toward a flechette-pocked cabinet, where a stream of sweet-smelling spirits was leaking from beneath closed doors.
Something to drink?
Ben frowned.
You mean intoxicants?
Omos's eyes brightened with amusement.
Worried that you're too young, Ben? That it's against the law?
He snorted in laughter, his tone brittle and close to hysterics.
Imagine that! Me trying to corrupt my assassin! Perhaps Jason can charge me with that, too.
That's not what I meant.
Ben didn't know why he felt so much on the defensive here. Perhaps because he was fairly certain that Omos did not deserve what was about to happen to him. That he was about to become collateral damage in a war so secret, even Jason didn't know about it.
But you go ahead. We've got a couple of minutes before Coruscant security arrives.
The look Omos shot Ben was more judgmental than shocked.
You mean you took out the whole detail guarding me?
Not dead.
Considering what he was about to do to Omos, what he had to do, Ben didn't know why he cared what his target thought of him. But he did. He deactivated his lightsaber, then pulled an empty cylinder off his equipment harness and tossed it to the chief. Omos was so badly shaken that he shied away from the cylinder. It bounced off the transparisteel wall and clanged to the floor without detonating or emitting anything noxious. Ben rolled his eyes.
It's an empty coma gas canister.
Omos exhaled in relief, then turned back to the cabinet.
That's good. Ben, I thought you had become, well, like Jason.
He selected an unshattered bottle, took down a single glass, and poured for himself.
But before you do this, there's something you need to know.
Omos opened his cloak and turned back to Ben, revealing a small scanner clipped to his tunic vest. Across the display ran a single line, rising and falling in the familiar pattern of a human heartbeat.
You're death-trapped?
Ben asked. Omos nodded.
A venerable tradition for deposed chiefs. You'll have to make sure I die slowly, or...
He cast a meaningful glance at the ceiling, suggesting it would come crashing down amid a torrent of flame and shockwave. Then he nodded toward the transparisteel viewing wall beside him.
And you can't go out that way, either. It's rigged to a thermal detonator.
Great.
Ben sighed. This operation was getting more complicated every second, and not because he had to find a new escape route. That was easy, compared with killing someone who was being kind to him.
Thanks, I guess.
Sorry, Ben. I had hoped it would be Jason standing there.
Ben shook his head.
Jason's too smart for that.
Omos shrugged.
Everyone makes mistakes,
he said.
I certainly made my share.
As Omos spoke, a pair of armored hover cars flew slowly past the viewing wall and began to circle back around. Omos watched them out of the corner of his eye, then pressed a button on his desk. A blast curtain descended over the transparisteel viewing wall, shielding the study from outside scrutiny.
It looks like we're running out of time,
Omos said. He tipped up his glass and drained the contents, then set it on the desk and stepped toward Ben, spreading his arms.
I'm sure you know better than I where to strike. Don't worry if it's painful. I've done enough to deserve that. Just give yourself plenty of time to escape. I don't want to leave this life with your death on my conscience.
Ben used the force to stop Omos from approaching. The fear and sadness in the chief's presence suggested that he was telling the truth. He truly did want to make this easy, and that was what made it so difficult for Ben to follow through on his plan.
Ben!
Omos was hanging in mid-step, still caught in Ben's force grasp.
Coruscant security has to be in the tower by now, and they won't care who you are, only that someone attacked me.
I can't do it,
Ben said. He pulled a recording rod from his tunic pocket.
Not until you know why.
Ben, I already know.
No, Chief,
Ben said.
You really don't.
Ben activated the recording rod, then watched Omos's eyes widen as he heard his own voice speaking, saying they needed to redirect Luke Skywalker's attention so his friends on the Jedi Council would be free to reinstate him. As the recording came to an end, any doubt lingering about the chief's complicity in the death of his mother vanished. A politician as practiced as Omos might have been able to fake the expression of horror that came to his face, but he would not have been able to feign the shock he was pouring into the Force, or the outrage and despair.